ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Our summer season has rolled around again, the time of year we celebrate the best of Late Night Live. The stories you loved in 2025, the stories you missed, the stories you're dying to hear again. Because there's so much magnificent material to choose from, curating the summer season has proved a hard task for the team. But we all agreed we should begin with Sarah McBride, the American historian and whiskerologist, who revealed the role played by hair in the political history of a country now ruled with a comb-over. But first, the painting Gough bought that enraged Tory Australia. I remember the fury when the news broke that Gough Whitlam's government had paid over $1 million to buy a painting for the unbuilt National Gallery. Not an old master, but a thing of drips and squiggles only 20 years old, Jackson Pollock's Blue Poles. Buying Blue Poles was used as a battering ram against Whitlam's government all the way to the dismissal. Tom McElroy has now written Blue Poles, Jackson Pollock, Gough Whitlam, and the painting that changed a nation. Tom was the man for this job. He's a political correspondent, but he also knows the art world. Tom joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, David.
Now, Tom, how was this painting on the market in the first place?
It's an amazing story. It was hanging in a private apartment on the Upper West Side of New York City. The owner, Ben Heller, a businessman and art collector, viewed the art that hung in his family's house as a gift and a temporary thing. He saw himself as the custodian rather than the owner. And he was always selling and buying and keeping his collection at the forefront of the art movement. And it had been known around the traps that he might be willing to sell this massive Jackson Pollock painting, the painting of his dear friend, one of the last great works of Pollock, if the price was right. And somehow, slowly and in a bit of a ham-fisted way, news reaches Canberra that the painting might be for sale.
Now, did Canberra know that he had offered this painting at lower prices to other possible buyers who'd all turned it down?
One of the things I learned pretty quickly with this project is there's not a lot of transparency in the art world. And when it comes to buying and selling artworks, there's some smoke and mirrors involved. I think probably James Mollison, who bought it for the gallery, was aware that the commercial market was a sometimes murky place. But it only comes out afterwards, the various proposals for the sale to different parties, the various offers that had been turned down. So I don't think there was much clarity right at the time, but it turns into quite a good deal for the Australian buyers, and the price was pretty good from the American perspective. It was then the most expensive American artwork ever sold.
But it was not just by a shade the most expensive. It was 8 times more than had ever been paid for an American work of art.
Yeah, there's kind of dueling controversies. One in Australia that we'd spent so much on this thing that no one could really understand by an artist from America that most people hadn't heard of. Certainly most people in Australia didn't have a sophisticated understanding of Pollock and what he was on about or abstract expressionism as a movement. And in America, there was controversy that a great artwork created there was being sold so far away overseas. And even Heller himself, the collector, had second thoughts. His wife tells stories of discovering him late at night sitting in front of the painting in their living room crying. He viewed it as he was very, obviously very close to Pollock. They had a real friendship in the late stages of Pollock's life. And Heller viewed this picture as something more than just an artwork, a really important time capsule of the period and of Pollock's work. And I think his second thoughts, his doubts about it really could have put this transaction at risk. If the deal hadn't already been done, it might have fallen over on his second thoughts.
What was James Mollison's mission? What was he on about?
Mollison must be one of the most important Australian cultural figures that not that many people in the contemporary period know about, I think. A public servant, a gallery executive, an arts leader in Australia. His mission was to put together a world-class sample of art for a national gallery in Australia, then unbuilt and still kind of being imagined as the process went along. And he took a broad view of what that should include. He wanted great paintings and sculptures. He wanted a span of history. He wanted historical and cultural artifacts as well. And he was aware that this movement of abstract expressionism, the New York School, was a really important part of modern art. And he, I think from the very start when he's corresponding with agents in New York, I think he sees the potential to really shake things up and catch people unaware with something like a Jackson Pollock painting. To hang next to Renaissance artworks, French Impressionism, great sculpture from centuries past, he wanted to make a statement with Blue Poles, and I think he achieved that.
Yes, I don't think we can doubt that. Tom, your newspaper broke the story. The Financial Review broke the story that this painting was on the way, but it didn't seem to cause much kerfuffle. It was not until the New York Times, some weeks later, took up the story that the discord in Australia began. Have I got the timeline right?
Yeah, I think you do. Terry Ingram, who was a writer for the Financial Review covering the arts world, got wind that there was a big acquisition in the works and that a lot of money was being spent on this painting by Jackson Pollock. And if you look at the front page at the time, there's a bit of mystery in there. He doesn't reveal, of course he doesn't reveal his sources, but he doesn't even really say which part of the transaction, where in the art world or in the government bureaucracy this news is emerging from. And he has to explain to people reading the Financial Review who Pollock is and why his work is so unlike anything they will have seen in galleries in Australia up to that point. He tried to contact the National Gallery. He went through official channels to try and get a response to the story. But writing on a Sunday afternoon for the front page on the Monday morning, I don't think his efforts were, by his own admission, completely genuine. I think he wanted to make sure he had the story to himself, and he didn't want the gallery putting out a press release or briefing other journalists and disrupting the story. But it's fascinating that it's on the front page of the AFR because I think if it had been in a different newspaper, indeed if it had been broken in the American press, probably the controversy would have been sparked quicker than it later was.
So Terry Ingram, the bastard, goes to his grave without telling you what his source was.
He was happy to talk about the story, but I asked a few times and I'm pleased to say, I didn't expect anything else if I'm honest, I'm pleased to say he wouldn't discuss anything about the source. He wouldn't tell me, were they a bureaucrat? Were they involved on the financial side of the deal? Were they in New York? Were they in Australia?
What's your hunch?
For some reason, my hunch is that it might have been someone in Canberra. I think the mechanics of getting this big amount of money to a private businessman in New York were going through the process. But we didn't speculate, and although I really enjoyed our conversation, I came away frustrated that he wouldn't tell me anything. And I'm sorry to say that Terry's died since that interview took place.
Well, I suppose as journalists we can say it was an honourable recourse of his to never tell.
Yes.
The price was announced on the first day by the Fin Review. The Fin had the price.
Yeah, that's right. This is a great part of the story. The people working for the National Gallery and putting together this collection, including Mollison and various committees dealing with acquisitions, had to seek approval from the Whitlam government and from the Prime Minister himself. This was something like a fifth of the acquisition budget in a single transaction. And they were aware that it would be controversial and that there would be questions asked about why Australia's National Gallery was purchasing American artworks, why it was this unusual drip painting, this huge canvas. And there's a great paper trail in the National Archives here in Canberra that details the conversations that went back and forth about how this news should be broken and indeed whether the public should know that effectively the Australian taxpayer was paying $1.4 million for this artwork. One of the memos, this historical gem that's just sitting here in Canberra, it's fantastic, a memo to Whitlam saying that this discussion had taken place and they needed to know from him whether the price would be made public, whether people would know. And of course, in the art market, flagging how much you're spending on something is a signal to other potential sellers and it can have a big effect on the value of an artist's work. Whitlam, in his wisdom, I think, scribbles at the bottom of the memo that the bureaucrats should buy the picture and disclose the price. And forevermore, this controversy is really seen through the lens of the dollar figure attached to the painting.
How on earth could they have imagined buying a painting of such value and keeping the price a secret? I mean, the naivety of such a suggestion and the obvious clarity of Whitlam's response. But anyway, is there any evidence, Tom, of Whitlam hesitating at this point?
I haven't found any evidence of that. I think he knew from the very start that this was going to be a transformational purchase. I think he knew that it was something that would forever be associated with him and with his government. From the very start, when he became the Labor leader and up to the 1972 It's Time election, Whitlam spoke about the importance of the arts. He said that to be a civilized society in the modern world, governments needed to foster the arts, that people needed the entertainment and enjoyment and challenge that the arts brought in public life and in our own personal imaginations. So I think he realised that this was a moment to put that into practice, to put his money where his mouth is, and he took it with both hands and he kind of never let go. He was forever proud of Blue Poles as part of his legacy, part of his government's legacy, up to the point that he and Margaret would put Blue Poles on their official Christmas card.
Yes, I remember that.
They
put it on the Christmas card.
Yeah, it was a break from tradition. Usually it would be a religious picture of some nature. Instead, it's Blue Poles, and it's so great. There's an original one of these cards in the archives here at the National Gallery. And they did it for years to come as well. Even after he left the Prime Ministership, Margaret would have Christmas cards produced with the Blue Poles picture.
Now, we'll get to that. That's down the track, Tom.
Sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
You are. I'll have to discipline you. This is Late Night Live on Radio National. I'm talking to the political journalist Tom McElroy, who has written this extraordinary, fascinating book on Jackson Pollock's Blue Poles, purchased by the Whitlam government and then used as an extraordinary weapon against that government. Now, let's get to the story of the weaponizing of the purchase. Not much kerfuffle when the Fin Review publishes the story, but a month later, when the New York Times does, sort of all hell breaks loose in Australia. What was happening?
It became a political weapon against the Whitlam government. There's question time debate in the House and the Senate about the purchase and about the government's priorities. Things were starting to get a little bit wobbly for the Whitlam government, and we all know how history plays out in that regard. The painting gets caught up in this growing storm of criticism about how public money is being spent and why the government is focusing on expensive art from overseas instead of housing or education or health. And Whitlam himself has to answer these criticisms in Parliament and in press conferences. And I think when you look at the transcripts of this time, you see his confidence in speaking about art. You see his pride in art being a front page issue in Australia. And I think probably, not to make a political comment, but with a bit of consideration about the time, I think he's probably more fluent in defending the picture than some of the critics are in attacking it. And I think he's got a smart and sophisticated understanding that this National Gallery, if it's going to be a world-class collection, it's going to need some world-class pictures.
There was also a financial crisis going on at the time, wasn't it? In the traditional way in our history, Labor comes to power and then faces a financial crisis. So a big purchase at this time, and it was by an order of, 10 times as much as ever been paid by an Australian gallery for a painting, perhaps 10's an exaggeration. Whitlam was talking, he was defending art in the face of high inflation, high unemployment, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and it was a real challenge. I think average voters, people in the suburbs around Australia could pretty easily think this government's priorities might be off. You know, they might not be thinking about what's important for me and my family. These are difficult times. I'm out of a job or I'm having trouble making my household budget stack up. And here's the federal government talking about art acquisitions for a gallery that hasn't even been built yet. It was good fodder for the Conservatives in opposition. They were able to effectively weaponize it. And I think it plays a small piece in the ultimate drama of the Whitlam government playing out a couple of years later in the dismissal. It gives people like Malcolm Fraser and a whole host of coalition MPs, Liberal and then Country Party MPs, the opportunity to say their priorities are warped, we can do a better job in governing Australia.
Was there anybody on the Conservative side who defended the purchase of the painting?
There are a few people. The critics really went to town on this, as your listeners will remember. And
Not all of them, Tom, be fair.
And the artistic community, the cultural community in Australia comes into bat for Blue Poles and for Whitlam and agrees that this is an important thing and really a landmark moment in the arts in Australia, even if it is an American artwork. But as I say, I think Whitlam was prepared for the fight and probably relished it, I think, right up until the end of his government a couple of years later.
Was this also a time when Australians got some sort of sense of who Jackson Pollock was?
Slowly, I think that they did. It's a great story. He has a fascinating life, and his personal development is during difficult times in the wake of the Great Depression and the pre-World War II period. He has a kind of self-created myth about his life that he's from the American West. He was born there, but in his early years was across in the East, living in New York. He was a difficult person. He was a terrible drunk and very difficult to be around, really quite rude a lot of the time, and was lucky that people recognised his talent, because otherwise I think a lot of people probably would have given up on Jackson Pollock. That story kind of plays out in the media here a little bit. If you look back through the clippings of the time, people are curious about Pollock. They want to know about the man behind this picture. And there's some potted histories of his life, even in newspapers and magazines here, explaining where this painting comes from and how it fits into the span of American art in the post-war period.
So how did the work actually get to Australia?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Anyone who's seen Blue Poles in the gallery here in Canberra will know how big it is. And moving an artwork is no small feat, even if it's a small canvas. In this case, it's huge and delicate. It was taken out of the window of the 10th floor apartment of the Hellers. I went to New York and stood on the street and looked up at where the window was to imagine it being brought down. They installed a pulley system on the railing on the side of the building, up above a very busy street on the edge of Central Park. And they, with removalists waiting at the bottom, they used this pulley to lower it down into the street. Television cameras filming, the traffic was stopped. And slowly but surely, with a stop in Washington, D.C. on the way, it's brought to Australia in a special container on board a ship. It has Defence Force assistance when it gets to Sydney, and it makes a tour around the state galleries and is seen by thousands and thousands of people. Blue Poles really makes a splash when it gets here, but it's not an easy thing to move.
Was it a warship that brought it here?
It was, yeah, it was. The Navy was involved. There was some secrecy about how it was actually done in real time. And there's not a lot, I struggled to find documents that actually detailed it, but there are pictures of it being unloaded and you can see this huge shipping container. And there are a great series of photos of the painting being carefully brought out in this wooden crate that was made for it. It was precious cargo, and they were sensitive to it from the very start, that it needed to be kept in the right climate conditions, that it needed to be handled really carefully. I find it ironic. I mean, Pollock mistreated his paintings, and before Blue Poles was sold for the first time, it sat rolled up in a stairwell, an unlocked stairwell at the back of the gallery in New York.
Jesus. Now, look, there's a detail in your book, if I got this right, that the painting was somehow covered in wax for the journey. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And even up until the period of COVID-19, just a few years ago, there's discoloration in elements of the painting that were removed in a huge restoration project here in Canberra just a few years ago. I think the understanding of how to protect and how to showcase artworks has really advanced in the last couple of decades. And taking off these layers of wax and varnish really improves paintings. When it was being restored in the wake of the pandemic, in those in-between years as we were kind of coming out of COVID, people visiting the gallery could see the restoration happening in real time. One person who knew I was working on the project said to me, "I saw Blue Poles. There's all this junk around it. They seem to be doing some kind of work." But the curator in charge of it was in real time taking off wax and varnish that had been on it for decades. And it looks fantastic now. The gallery's got a new set of lighting and it's got pride of place in the gallery now. It's really a sight to see.
Let's go back to its first exhibition in Australia. Of course, there was no National Gallery. So it was first shown, I think, in the New South Wales Art Gallery?
Yeah, that's right.
And what was the response of people? I mean, were there mockers? Were there applauders? How did the sight of the painting change the argument?
I think the presence of the painting is an important first step in the changing of the argument. There were definitely mockers. There's a famous photo of the actor Paul Hogan standing in front of it. He's literally holding his nose, clearly unimpressed, and posing for the Daily Telegraph newspaper. Thousands of people lined up in Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide. There were gala events for people, you know, VIPs to come and see Blue Poles. Some people, I think, were confirmed in their dislike of it. They stood in front of it. They couldn't quite grasp what Pollock was on about. You have to, even today, I think, stand and kind of take it all in one go, which is difficult because of its size. The media controversy gets a second life in this period. You know, the tabloid newspapers, even the ABC and other media outlets are talking to people about what they think of Blue Poles. And there's some pretty mixed reviews, to put it lightly. I think a lot of people really didn't like the picture, didn't understand why Australia had spent so much money on it. And you think if it's in the National, in the Art Gallery of New South Wales or the Art Gallery of South Australia, it really would be a break with tradition, these beautiful ornate buildings, and here's this flash of modernity. You can understand why people found it jarring. I think probably our appreciation for it has matured, though it still has its critics even today, and some people, I think, are happy in never really understanding what's going on.
Pollock said, "Don't look at it necessarily as a work of art. Look at it as a garden."
Yeah, he wasn't good at speaking about his artworks. Every so often he has a quotable quote like that you think, oh, there really is something there. He really understood how he was breaking the mold for American art. He was a good self-promoter in some ways, and his wife, Lee Krasner, was also an artist, was particularly good at advocating for him, acting as his agent and helping him tell the story. But I like to think, I wonder what Pollock would have made of the controversy in Australia. He certainly didn't know much about Australia and never came here in his lifetime. But yeah, he says, you need to look at it in different ways. You need to think of the abstract nature of it. You need to see almost figurative elements. And the poles itself, these blue lines that run across the painting, have special meaning as well. You can feel Pollock's kind of DNA, his artistic journey, demonstrated completely in this picture. It's appropriate that it comes towards the end of his life.
In Parliament, after he'd been defeated, God, I love this, Whitlam said, "The value of the painting is difficult to assess, but to anyone who still regards blue poles as a waste of money, I merely say this, let them sell it."
There are people in Parliament today who would sell it if they had the opportunity. The gallery has it insured for $500 million. It will never be sold. And I wonder if it'll travel again. It's been able to travel. It was most recently in London in the past 10 years, I guess. I don't think it, I mean, it simply could never be sold, but it continues to act as a lightning rod for the culture wars and for debate about the value of art in an artistic sense and the value of art in a dollars and cents sense.
And can you imagine the National Gallery without it?
Increasingly, I can. I think if you think of the Louvre without the Mona Lisa, or the Gallery of the Academy in Florence without the Statue of David, it probably is missing a beating heart. Here, people come to see blue poles, and I think they find themselves immersed in a collection that is much greater and much more substantial than one picture. It's become a icon of Canberra, and in that sense, I think that it has to stay, and we'd be less of a city without it. But the gallery collection is very mature now. In the decades since, it has real reach, and it's increasingly doing a great job of telling stories that the art world has forgotten along the way, not least putting colonial Australian art next to Indigenous art and telling the role of female artists who have been forgotten by the art world, things like that. So in one sense, I can imagine blue poles not being there and the gallery still being excellent. But in another sense, it'd be a piece of Canberra missing if it wasn't here.
Tom, thank you very much. I've been speaking to Tom McElroy, the author of Blue Poles, Jackson Pollock, Gough Whitlam and the Painting That Changed a Nation, published by Hachette. Tom, thanks very much for joining us on the show.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, David.
Last question. Can you still buy Christmas cards with Jackson Pollock on them?
I haven't seen one. You can buy almost everything else. Tires, puzzles, posters, postcards, whatever you like.
Or tea towels?
Tea towels, magnets, all kinds of kitsch. I've been looking for a Christmas card. I'd like to use it for Christmas cards as well.
Good. Look, that's a mutual response. I'm certainly going to do it. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Thanks, David. I really appreciate it.
Up next, Whiskers and Wisdom.
David Marr on ABC Radio National.
Hair matters. How we cut and curl and bleach and trim and shave has always said a lot about us. It's personal and very visible. But in 19th century America, how hair was worn came to signify big things, not least class, race, even trustworthiness. With large and naturally glossy black whiskers, wrote a New Orleans journalist in the 1840s, we always associate honesty of mind and firmness of purpose. He called the study of character via hair whiskerology. A couple of centuries later, the historian Sarah Gold McBride, a lecturer in the American Studies program at the University of California, Berkeley, has written Whiskerology, the Culture of Hair in 19th Century America. Sarah joins me now. Sarah, what happened in the 19th century to make people suddenly so conscious about hair?
So the big change of the 19th century, as you noted, hair has always been important. People in cultures and communities all across the country, probably since humans had hair in the first place, have been drawing meaning from that hair. But what changed in the 19th century, beginning in the 18th and really solidified by the 19th, was an emphasis on biology, that hair mattered because it was biological. In the colonial period in the pre-United States, the English colonies, hair mattered for its style. whether a person chose to grow their hair long or cut it short, or whether they wore a wig, and if so, what kind. These kinds of stylistic choices mattered, and they might communicate, for example, religious identification. But in the 19th century, what changed was biology, that hair was suddenly understood not just as this external decorative thing that is similar to clothing or makeup or jewelry, but that hair was of the body, that it grew out of the body. And therefore, increasingly in the 19th century, it was understood really to be a body part. And I don't use that metaphorically. In so many of my sources, people talk about hair as a part of the body, that, for example, to have a haircut is to have an operation. To be frequently getting haircuts is to have your hair kept bleeding by the barber. So hair was truly understood to be this part of the body, integral as an arm or a leg or an ear or a nose. And in so doing, this emphasis on hair's bodily nature made its biology so significant that it could communicate core biological truths about the person from whose body it grew. And moreover, some of the hairstyles that had been meaningful in previous centuries, all of a sudden they are assigned these biological inevitabilities. For example, that only white men could grow beards, that no one else was capable of growing a beard other than white men. And, you know, if you saw a few hairs on the chin or the cheek of a man of color, well, that wasn't a beard after all, that was something different. So these stylistic choices, whether it's facial hair or long hair or short, become freighted with the weight of biology. And in so doing, the gravity and the significance of hair becomes so much stronger in that century.
And the fact that only white men could grow beards said a lot about the power of men and white men.
Yes, exactly. Yes. The beard is actually where this book began. When I was a graduate student, I was researching bearded ladies. I was curious about freak shows, which were an enormously popular form of entertainment in 19th century America. And in the doing of researching bearded ladies, I learned just how important beards became symbolically as these markers of white masculinity and in so doing of political citizenship in the 19th century. That there is almost no facial hair to be found in the United States prior to the 1850s. And then from about the 1850s until the first decade of the 20th century, all of a sudden, beards everywhere, mustaches everywhere. The sort of illustration of this ubiquity is looking at the presidents. So the first American president to have facial hair was Abraham Lincoln, who's elected in 1860. And from Lincoln's election until William Howard Taft leaves office in the 19-teens, only one president is ever elected without any kind of facial hair. Every single other elected president has a mustache, a beard, sideburns, or some combination. So yes, the beard becomes this marker of masculinity, of whiteness, and therefore of political power in that second half of the century.
Now, Sarah, please, let us just not neglect bearded ladies.
Two questions here. Happy to talk about bearded ladies.
Two questions here. How is it that women from time to time can have a full beard? And why do you think they were objects of such fascination? You know, why were they in freak shows?
So the first question, there is just some small percentage of women who grow facial hair. There are quite a few studies in contemporary medicine of trying to quantify the percentage of women who grow some amount of facial hair. And the numbers range. Some of the studies look just at white women. Some look at Black women or women from other racial groups. But there is something, I think, if I recall correctly, it's something about 10 to 20% of women grow some kind of hair on their face. Now, of course, hair removal has been available as a technology for a long time. You know, the kinds of technologies have changed, certainly, but there are recipes for hair removal in cookbooks and other kinds of personal care guidebooks for a really long time. So there's just some women just grow facial hair on their faces still to this day, certainly. And in the 19th century, the very first bearded lady was named Madame Clafoulia. That was her stage name. And she came from Europe and she was born with quite a lot of hair on her face, and it just continued to grow. And she came to the United States in the 1850s to perform with none other than P.T. Barnum, the most famous person of the 19th century U.S. and the preeminent purveyor of unusual people and unusual bodies. And she was such a sensation that she basically created almost this character, this archetype, that freak show after freak show all across the country all of a sudden have to have a bearded lady. By the early 20th century, the manager of one of these collections of unusual bodied people, it's called the Congress of Strange People, he says, a bearded lady, they're so expected. Every single freak show has one. That's why I liken it to a clown in the circus. It's sort of an expectation by the audience. So the bearded lady is a sensation as early as the 1850s. And what I argue in the book is that there is a way in which a lot of freak show characters, the kinds of reoccurring figures you'd see from show to show, many of them do trouble a boundary of some kind. So, for example, people with albinism, people who are albino, so they sort of trouble a racial boundary between whiteness and blackness. People who are little people or dwarves trouble a boundary between youth and adulthood. So on the surface, we might categorize the bearded lady as troubling a gender boundary. But what I argue in the book is that it's more than that. There's something very historically particular about the way that the bearded lady never hid her beard. She was not trying to remove it. She was instead making money off of it. She was standing on a stage for all to see. She was celebrating it. And contemporary observers, men in particular, who were increasingly concerned about women, white women especially, pushing into realms of political and social life, trying to, for example, push for the right to vote, concerned about women not knowing their place, not staying in their place, and they immediately, as soon as she arrives in the U.S., are comparing Madame Clafoulia to women's rights activists, saying these are two groups of women who are not knowing their place.
Wow. Wow. Now, meanwhile, American men stop shaving. Now, why? Why do they stop shaving?
It's a great question, and it's one that I don't think there's a single answer to. There are some scholars who've looked at the popularity of facial hair, first mustaches and then beards in Europe, especially in France and England, which are two of the sort of cultural authorities for early Americans in particular, with elements of scholarship and style and culture. So there's a way in which we might see sort of a trend that begins overseas and comes to the United States a few decades later. That probably explains some of the beards. There are some famous bearded celebrities that visit from Europe to the United States for a speaking tour that might have influenced some men's decisions to stop wearing beards. There's also some evidence, especially in the South, a lot of the barbers of the colonial period and early 19th century were Black men. And there's a way in which some men seem to have felt by the middle of the century increasingly nervous as the political strife over slavery grew increasingly urgent, a little bit nervous about having their throats sort of bare to a Black man with a razor. And so there's some evidence of white men who thought, well, I'll just try to shave myself. I don't need to go to the barber anymore. But then this is an era before safety razors and before easy access to good lighting and good mirrors and good water. And so some of these men probably found it's actually terrible to try to shave yourself at home.
But Sarah, this could go to the virtue of those people who have better things to do with their time than shave.
Yes, I think some of it too is wartime. Some scholars had attributed all of the beards to the Civil War, saying, oh, it's so hard to shave when you're on the battlefield. And certainly there were probably some men who grew facial hair for the first time at war, but there's evidence that it actually predates the Civil War. And that's why I find that probably the likeliest answer is it's a combination of many different things. And then there's this kind of snowball effect with more and more men wearing beards and writing all of these books and pamphlets and articles about how beards are so great, that they save you time, they save you money, they save you trips to the barber, and a beard has all these health-giving powers too. They write about the protection of the throat to keep you from getting sick, and of course, all of this is tied up with masculinity. That comparisons between the beard and the horns on a deer, for example, or the mane on a lion, that these are signs of masculinity, and that American men really need to show their masculinity on their faces.
But they've always been signs of wisdom, haven't they? Prophets had beards.
Yes, there are. They're so true. There is this long history of beard wearing. And a lot of these contemporary, the 19th century writing about beards will turn to these ancient examples and say, think about all these wise men of ancient life who wore beards. And shouldn't we now again start to emulate their decisions to wear beards as they did. There is this sort of, it's not perfectly cyclical in any kind of predictable way, but there is this, the human history of beard wearing in the Western world, as we know it, has been some periods of beardedness and some periods of barefaced. And it's sort of gone back and forth over time. And the U.S. Was founded in an era of largely barefacedness in England and the new U.S. both. And so the beards and the other facial hair forms really just come back in the mid-century.
And there has always been a social contest over hair length.
Yes. Yes, it's so... This is also a really interesting element of early American history, is that we have all these iconic illustrations and paintings of famous early American figures, the founding fathers, George Washington and his colleagues. And they're always wearing these long white wigs. And then within a few decades, American men, by the beginning of the 19th century, American men are wearing short hair like it's a uniform, as if it is assigned to you when you become an adult. It is almost, it's really, really challenging to find any white men, and the evidence is more scant for Black men, but Black men as well, almost any men wearing their hair long. This is not the case for indigenous North American men, who many of whom continue to wear long hair throughout the 19th century. But for white men, for Black men, and also for indigenous men who lived in white communities, short hair was so uniform. But what I found when I started my research is that there wasn't really a good explanation for why. We could say why the wigs went away.
Why is that? Why did we give up those stupid wigs?
So it's probably, again, a combination of things. I know that's not the neat answer we would love to have. But in part, I think there is a lot of scholarship suggesting that part of the decision to stop wearing wigs is about the revolution. It's about the wig symbolizing British aristocracy, symbolizing the king and the crown. There's a source I have where an American man says, the wig is no different than a crown, and we don't allow crowns in America, so why should we allow wigs either? That it was this material object that reminded early Americans too much of England. And it's true that other goods that were British in nature were also cast aside in the aftermath of the Revolution. But I find that an incomplete explanation. Because it's not all men wore wigs in the colonial period. There's actually, a less, not very well-known fact is that most of our iconic images of George Washington, he's not actually wearing a wig. He is wearing his hair styled to look as if it were a wig, which tells you just how popular wig wearing was. But he wore his own hair long, and he had it powdered and styled and looked like wig styles of the period. So it's not simply the case that men stopped wearing their wigs. It's also that men like Washington himself, who would have worn long hair in a previous generation, are cutting it short. And what I found in my research is that this is really the more profound shift, that the rejection of the wig is part and parcel of this shortening of white men's hair. And an argument that to wear one's hair short is necessary for American masculinity. This is, of course, the moment where Americans are defining who is an American, who is a citizen of the United States, who has political rights, who should have the right to vote, for example, or hold office. And there's this argument that to wear short hair is a sign of a man's ability to be his own master. And this language of master, it's very racially coded. Of course, it alludes to enslavement, to enslaved people of African descent who are not their own masters. But there's a suggestion that to wear one's hair short is simple. It doesn't require a lot of time. It doesn't require a lot of labor. And it is a way to show that you have self-mastery over your own body and that you therefore have the right kind of masculinity to be a political citizen of this new nation.
On Late Night Live, I'm speaking to Sarah Gold McBride, historian and author of Whiskerology. Meanwhile, was there anything like similar controversy over the length of women's hair?
Yes, women's hair is long in for a really long time. There are biblical passages, biblical mandates that state women must have long hair. 1 Corinthians is the most commonly cited passage in the colonial period as well as in the 19th century, where leaders of the church will say, it's very clear in 1 Corinthians that women must wear their hair long as a covering, as a form of a sign of their religious worship and their religious observance. And that it's not enough to wear a hat or a bonnet or some other kind of covering. The hair itself must be long. So long hair has this religious grounding for Christian people since the beginning of English colonization. The Puritans were especially, Puritan leaders are yelling about hair a lot in the 17th century. And they're very concerned about the hair care practices, the style of hair, again, not its biology yet. So they're saying 1 Corinthians is very clear, women must have long hair. It is given to them by God as a covering. And in the 19th century, we see this, again, this assignment of biological inevitability to long hair, claims that only women can grow long hair, that men simply cannot grow their hair long, a lot of scientific and cultural authorities begin to say. And not only is long hair on women a sign of their religious observance, it becomes also a sign of their femininity, this notion that of a kind of binary, really, that men should wear short hair because it is simple, it doesn't require a lot of time, you're not enslaved to, they would literally use these words, enslaved, you're not enslaved to your barber, to your valet, your personal care person. You're not enslaved to style. You have simple short hair, and that's because you're a man. And on the other hand, decorativeness, fashion, a lot of time and labor spent styling one's hair, that is appropriate for women alone.
But from China to the United States of America came men who wore their hair long. And that became a big cultural focus.
Yes. In the middle of the 19th century, after the gold rush in California, all of a sudden, this new group of immigrants began arriving in largely, mostly in California in the West. And these are men from China. And the Chinese law at the time mandated that men of Han ethnicity must wear their hair in a long length and in a style known as a queue. It's sort of like a ponytail or a braid that begins at the top of the head and extends down the back. And virtually all of the Chinese immigrant men who came to California in the 19th century were of Han ethnicity. And so they wore their queues with them when they came to California. And it's really striking. I looked at a lot of visual culture to study how white Americans perceived and received and interpreted Chinese men. And they were obsessed with the queue. They drew it in these fantastical fashions where the queue is flying through the air as if it has no gravity. It's there's illustrations of Chinese men doing acrobatics hung by their hair or being held up by their hair by an angry white shopkeeper or something. They see the queue as this signal that Chinese men are unassimilable, that they are alien racially, and that their masculinity is wrong too, that there is something effeminate or feminine about them. And there's other signs too that reinforce this meaning that hair seems to transmit, that Chinese men largely don't have jobs as independent farmers or as shop owners, that they are working, as so many immigrants have done then and now, in lower paying jobs. And many, even California local laws made it illegal for Chinese people to buy land, for example. So they would do jobs that are coded feminine in white culture, like laundry or personal domestic servant, for example. So there are these other signifiers that suggest something is not right about the masculinity of Chinese men, but the hair becomes really this container for this whole array of almost irreconcilable assumptions about Chinese men, that they are, on the one hand, so effective at their work that they're going to put all the white men in California out of business. There's all this worker anxiety Chinese men are so efficient. So on the one hand, they're these almost like supermen, amazing workers. But at the same time, they are called effeminate or feminine, or, you know, not masculine enough. And it's sort of, how do we reconcile these two visions of Chinese people at the same time, Chinese men in particular? And I see the hair as the one thing that kind of bridges those two assumptions, that the hair was long like white women's hair, but it was also drawn so strong, these examples of the hair, you know, holding the body weight up, of a Chinese person, that the hair is both strong and it signifies weakness, femininity and weakness in a way. So it kind of reconciles these different conflicting visions of Chinese men, all of which see them as decidedly outside of political citizenship.
A last issue in this immensely rich field. Scientific studies in the 19th century seem to establish the fact that if you looked across the criminal population, there were far fewer blondes than black-haired criminals. Mm. And therefore, there was something kind of innately trustworthy about blondes.
Yes, the attempt to assign something meaningful in hair that could almost predict criminality. This is something that really becomes important to police detectives in major American cities in the final decades of the 19th century, that the United States is, over the course of the century, getting bigger, larger population, thanks to immigration and expansion. And cities are growing in these huge rates. And there's a lot of nervousness that when you go to a city or when you're in a city, that you don't know anyone there, or you don't know how to know who to trust. And so, and moreover, crime becomes a preoccupation, that cities are dangerous havens for criminals who will take advantage of the anonymity and the mobility of city populations. And so, therefore, it's suggested that there's a lot of interest in trying to find some way to pinpoint a person who is likely to commit a crime. This is, again, we're in an era before fingerprint technologies or other kinds of identifiers of individual identity. And there are some use of photography to try to capture who are the known criminals, they would say, in a given city. But there's a lot of interest in the research by this Italian criminologist named Cesare Lombroso, who writes this book, The Criminal Man, who argues exactly what you just said, that if he counted the incidence of hair color among hundreds of criminals, and he controlled for the country of origin they were from, and then he found that black hair was the most common and blonde hair less common. Now, I think on its surface, blonde hair in general in most parts of the world is just not that common in adults, right? That there's a fair number of
except in Scandinavia,
blonde children.
Perhaps.
Right, exactly, except in Scandinavia. But in Italy, where Lombroso is writing, and in the United States, where his work is eagerly translated, blondness is simply not common in general among adults. And so to find fewer blonde people in any population is probably not a surprise. But there's something also important about black hair here, because the characteristics that he flags as inherently marking the body of a criminal, someone criminally inclined, someone born to become a criminal, a lot of these characteristics are racialized. They're the same kinds of characteristics that might be described, that might be used to describe a person of African descent. He would say, for example, they had crisply textured hair, or that their hair was black, for example. There's a suggestion, in other words, that there's almost something, you know, from a 19th century imagining of humans existing along a spectrum, a racial spectrum, in which white Europeans are at the top of that ladder, and for many Americans, African-descended people are at the very bottom. A suggestion that criminally inclined people were almost like they're sliding down that ladder of civilization, that despite their ancestry maybe European, but if they are criminals, they're going to demonstrate the same bodily characteristics, the same hair in this case, as a person of African descent.
Oh, the pitfalls, oh, the horrors. Now, look, we're on radio, Sarah, and I think we should lay our cards on the table for our listeners. My hair is short and grey. Yours?
My hair is curly and brown, though increasingly gray as well.
Excellent. Good to know. The riches of this subject are just immense. Sarah, thank you. I've been talking to Sarah Gold McBride, historian at the University of California, Berkeley, about her book, Whiskerology, The Culture of Hair in 19th Century America, published by Harvard University Press. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
And that's the show. On our next, we're joined by the Canadian-Egyptian journalist Omar El-Akkad, who posted that famous tweet about Gaza early on. One day, everyone will always have been against this.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.